Good evening. We're holding Parshat Ba'alotcha. We're doing Parsha Summary Wednesday night. Our Parsha is the third Parsha in Sefer Bamidba. And our Parsha is the last Parsha before the Chet HaMeraglim. It's the last Parsha before the Jews are going to send off the spies, and the decree that they will spend 40 years in the desert will come upon them. So our parasha deals with the second year that we're in the desert. We left Egypt, we left Mitzrayim on the 15th of Nisan. That's why we celebrate Pesach on the 15th of Nisan. And 50 days later we got the Torah, right? That's Sfiras Omer till Vav Sivan. And then for the next year, minus 10 days, we spent at Mount Sinai learning the Torah. Of course, we have the Chet HaEgel that happened a short time later. The Jews sin with the Egel and the Luchos are broken, and then the second set of Luchos and forgiveness on Yom Kippur. And then we're there until the month of Iyar, and that's what we're going to encounter in our Parsha, that the Jewish people travel from Har Sinai and they're headed for the land of Israel. We're supposed to enter the land of Israel. And in our parsha, we're going to see how we depart from Sinai and immediately we encounter troubles. The people sin, and a fire, a heavenly fire, comes down from heaven and kills a lot of people, and then the people repent. The people sin again, and they start complaining. They want meat. They want to have all the different foods that they had in Egypt. They want the women that they were allowed to have in Egypt. And again, the people are punished. Moshe turns to Hashem and says, how could I do it alone? If I don't have help over here, I can't do it. And and Hashem appoints the 70 elders and sends special meat for the people. The people eat from the meat, and many of them drop dead. And we have the end of the parsha, an interesting story of Miriam and Aaron speak about Moshe, and Miriam is punished. She turns white. She gets a tzaras. And that's in short our parsha. Obviously, we've skipped a lot of details, and that's what we're going to fill in now. So our parsha begins with a commandment that we have to wonder why it's over here, the commandment of how to light the menorah. Hashem tells Moshe, tell Aaron, when you light the menorah, the special candelabra that's in the holy, you should light it in a fashion that the seven candles, six are facing towards one. We'll explain in a second. So the first question we have to ask ourselves, what's this doing here? In Sefer Shmos, we had a description of the building of the Mishkan. Why is this over here? So our sages say that in last week's parsha, we read about how the Mishkan was erected and each tribe brought special sacrifices at the culmination, at the Chanukat HaMizbeach, special ceremony. They began Chanukat HaMishkan, they began using the Mishkan. And every tribe was represented other than the tribe of Levi. So Aaron is standing on the sidelines and he's wondering, what am I going to offer? Every tribe is offering an offering and I'm not. So Hashem said, yours is greater than theirs. You get to offer every day, and that's why our parasha begins with the offering that the Kohen Aaron, the Kohen Gadol, every day lights the menorah. So our sages say this is also an allusion to the holiday of Chanukah, that Aaron was upset that at Chanukat HaMizbeach, the celebration of starting to use the Mishkan, every tribe is represented, and God told him, your Chanukah is going to be greater than theirs. And on the festival of Chanukah, really, the ones who won the war were Aaron's offsprings, the Kohanim. So God tells Moshe, tell Aaron that when he lights the Nerot, we have to define what are Nerot. In modern Hebrew, Nerot are candles. And in the Gemara, in the Mishnah, we find that Nerot mean the cups that contain the oil and the wicks. It's not the wick, it's not a candle, but rather it's the cup that contains the wick and the oil. So when Aaron lights the menorah, there's a special fashion in as to how he should light it. Now, there's a machlokas in the Mishnah, how the menorah was situated. Was the menorah standing east-west or north-south? So let's get a picture of how the Mishkan is built, or how the Beis HaMikdash was. We have everything facing towards the west. The holiest place is the west. You enter from the east, and there's a Tosefta that says this is how shuls should be erected, where the entrance is from the east, and the holy, the ark, is in the west. The Rambam paskins that we don't have that, but the Rambam seems to have had that. That the entrance to the shuls was always on the east, and the entrance to the Beis HaMikdash was on the east, and to the Mishkan was on the east. And as you proceed westward, you get holier and holier. First you enter the section where the in the Mishkan you had the Mizbech, in the Beis HaMikdash you had the Ezras Noshim, then Ezras Yisrael, Ezras Kohanim, and finally you reach the Mizbech, and then you get to the section Ben HaOlam El HaMizbech, the section between the Mizbeach and the Ulam, which is, so to speak, the quarter, the hall that's going to enter to the holy, over there, that's a holier section. Even Kohanim didn't enter there unless they were there in service. And then you enter the Ulam. You have the Kodesh, the holy. We're almost as west as can be until the Holy of Holies. Now in the holy, in the Kodesh, you have the menorah. You have the menorah, you have the shulchan, you have the table which has the 12 loaves of bread on it, and has the bazichei levona, the two spoonfuls of levona. And it has the special mizbech hanechoshet. It has that mizbech, the smaller mizbech made of copper that's a hand's width, a hand's length by a hand's length, an amma by an amma. And the menorah that's situated there, so the question is, was it facing north-south? In which case, just a second, or was it facing east-west? Now, if it's standing east-west, so let's imagine this piece of paper is the Mishkan. Now, all the way on the left, all the way on the west, let's see if you guys better over here, right? This is your left, all the way on the west is the Holy of Holies. Okay, so all the way on the left is the Holy of Holies. And then you have the Holy over here. You have the menorah. Now, the menorah, let's say it's standing going from north to south, right? So on its west is the Holy of Holies. If it's going north to south, then you have the seven candles are all going lengthwise down the length of the Holy of Holies. So which one is the one that's facing the Holy of Holies? The center one. And if that's the case, then you'd have three candles with their wicks facing the central one, and the three on the north had their candles facing the center one, and the center one would be facing the Holy of Holies. That's one understanding. That's if the menorah is going north to south. If the menorah is going east to west, so then which one is closest to the Holy of Holies? The one that's most westward. But we derive from the Psukim that the one that's most westward isn't the most important one. That's not the one that's called Ner Ma'aravi. It's the one after that, second to the closest. And then all the candles east of that would be facing west towards that candle. And the one candle that's west of that is facing east towards that one candle. So we have the important candle is the Ner Ma'aravi, the western candle. And if the candles are all equidistant from the Holy of Holies, they're going north-south, so then the Ner Ma'aravi would be the middle one. And then you'd have three facing, each side is facing the middle candle. And if the menorah is standing going east-west, so then we say the Ner Ma'aravi is the second one from the last, almost the most westward one, and then all the candles were facing that one. So the Torah says that the candles all have to face that way. What's the idea? What do we care if the candles are facing in, facing out? So there are two mitzvahs in the Torah. There's a mitzvah in the morning to fix the candles, to take off the ash, to put in new oil. And there's a mitzvah at night, as the sun sets in the evening, to light the menorah. So if one looks at it from a simple standpoint, he'd say, yeah, it's getting dark. So God doesn't want to be in darkness in the holy and holy of holies. So he's telling us to light the menorah. That's when everyone turns on the lights at night. Our sages say no. God gives light to the world. The Jews are traveling 40 years in the desert. He sends them a special fire to guide them. He lights up the desert for them. God doesn't need our light. God isn't telling us to light the menorah for the sake of light. So God says, have all the candles pointing inward, so to speak, to minimize the light. And that's to symbolize that God isn't giving us the commandment to light the menorah for the sake of light. He doesn't need the light of the menorah. In the Beis HaMikdash, there were windows. King Solomon built the Beis HaMikdash with windows. So in ancient times, when they had windows, so the windows would always get wider as it entered the house, so that the light would spread into the house. And the Beis HaMikdash, Shlomo HaMelech erected the Beis HaMikdash with windows that got wider as they went outward. And that was to symbolize that the Beis HaMikdash isn't getting light from outside, but rather the Beis HaMikdash is lighting up the world. So the windows would get wider as they expanded outwards. So the same concept here, God is saying, I don't need the light. I gave you a commandment to light the menorah in the evening, but it's not because I need the light. What do you want to ask?
No, I'm wondering, isn't it the Torah that, three candles of each side, they are facing the middle one?
That's according to the understanding that the menorah was standing north-south. That's a machlokas tanaim. No, the Torah says they should all be facing a specific candle. Elmu penei ha-menorah. To the face of the menorah, they should all light. The Torah doesn't say what that means. They should all face the menorah. So where Chazal call it that they're all facing the ner ma'aravi, the western candle. Which is the western candle? Well, if the menorah is standing north-south, they're all equidistant from the west. So then we say it's the middle candle. If the menorah is standing west-east, so we derive from the psukim, it's not the westernmost candle, but the second to the westernmost candle. Now, almost what? Yeah, it would be dark. The Holy of Holies was probably dark at night, yeah. At day and at night, we're not going into the question of did they have other sources of light in the Mishkan and in the Beis HaMikdash. Think of the Mishkan. You have in the Mishkan coverings upon coverings. Sunlight can't get through. So they had to have another source of light in the Mishkan, even by day. So I don't know of any source in the Torah that describes it, but they must have had another source of light, even by day, in any place in the Mishkan. Also in the Beis HaMikdash. So they had other sources of light. In the Beis HaMikdash, we have sources for it. In the Mishkan, I don't remember seeing anyone that discusses it, but there must have been candelabra somewhere. They had other sources of light in the Mishkan and in the Beis HaMikdash. So Aaron lights the menorah as he's told. And there's a special commandment here. The Torah describes it, b'ha'alotcha et hanirot, when you uplift the candles or the lamps. What does it mean when you uplift? Beha'alotcha. So our sages learn from here that when you light the menorah, Aaron was commanded to leave the candle there by the wick until the flame was standing on its own. Meaning when you light something, you could just touch the wick, and when it catches, you remove the flame, and then it goes down a little bit till it catches better. And the commandment is you leave the flame by the wick till the flame is standing solid, and when you'll pull away your candle, the flame won't go down. It's fully lit. And the same thing is true. We apply it to lighting Shabbos candles. One should ideally, when you light Shabbos candles, tell your wives, or when you yourselves, if you're in a situation where you're going to light your own Shabbos candles, like if you're in your own apartment. So firstly, you should make sure to do it safely. There have been too many fires in our history. But when you light it, you should know that you should leave the candle there till it lights on its own. And the same thing is true with lighting Hanukkah candles. Ideally, one should leave the candle there till the wick is standing on its own. The flame has consumed most of the wick that's extending from the candelabra, and it's going on its own. The Torah describes the menorah as being made of solid gold. It was one big block of gold that had to be chiseled out. They couldn't put it together out of pieces. This is the ideal sense. This is the way it was in the Mishkan, but in the time of the Second Temple, when we were overtaken by the Greeks and the Asmoneans came back in time Hanukkah, they couldn't build a menorah like this. So they built a menorah out of wood. This is the ideal way to have a menorah. This was the way it had to be in the Mishkan. But when they couldn't have it this way, they had it other ways. Our sages say that Moshe Rabbeinu had a hard time figuring out how to build the menorah. So there are different opinions as to how it worked. The Torah says, "Bezim asam noad." This is how the menorah was done. So one understanding says that God had to point to him. God had to show him a menorah and fire. And once he saw it, he was able to construct it on his own. Another understanding says that he said, "God, I can't do it." So God said, "Okay, you throw the block of gold into the fire and it'll come out fixed." That God really made the menorah. God tells Moshe to take the Levim and to purify them. They're going to get sprinkled from the Parah Aduma water, the water with the red heifer, the ashes of the red heifer, and they have to shave themselves clean. They're going to be all bald. And then they have to put their clothing in the mikveh, and they have a special sacrifice that's brought, and a special procession that the Levim are going to be, from now on, representing the Jewish people. This has halachic relevance. Our sages ask, why did the Levim have to shave and have the Parah Aduma water sprinkled on them? What did they do wrong? So our sages say that the Levim are coming instead of the Kohanim, right? They're coming instead of the firstborn. And the firstborn had sinned in the Chet HaEgel. They had served the golden heifer. They had done Avodah Zarah. And Avodah Zarah is called Zivchei Metim. It's like bringing sacrifices to the dead. We consider idols and idol worship as something that's completely defiled. And when one detaches himself from something defiled, one has to purify himself. A person who has tzaras, a person who has those white spots, might be it's a leper, we don't know exactly what it is, some kinds of white spots that the Torah says cause him to be spiritually defiled. When he becomes pure, he has to shave his body. He has to shave. He's going to be bald. He's going to be without a beard, without hair on his head. He's going to shave the clumps of hair that are seen on his body, his eyebrows. So we say that a person who serves idols is like a person who became a metzora. It's like he had tzaras. It's like he had those white spots. When a person leaves Avodah Zarah, when he wants to purify himself from his idol worship, so he has to undergo a procession that's similar to what the Metzorah has to undergo. He has to shave his body and go to the mikveh. And therefore the Levim, who are coming in place of the firstborns who served idols, had to undergo this procession. So all this sounds like a medrash, and you hear it, and you continue. The only problem is that it shows up in halacha. The halacha says that if a person becomes a ger, or a person is chozer b'tshuva, and he used to serve idols, he was of another religion, which would be considered idol worship, so then part of the procession is he has to shave his hair, shave all his head, shave everything, and then immerse himself. And even a person who was Jewish, and is chozer b'tshuva, he spent time with another religion, but really he was Jewish all along. He was born Jewish, and then he decides he's going to do tshuva. So the custom was so strong that they wouldn't consider him for a minyan until he underwent this procession. It doesn't say it in the Gemara. It's unclear where this custom comes from, but the custom appears in the Shulchan Aruch. The Ramah brings it. The Ramah brings it even in the laws of Yom Tov. He brings it in two places. It's brought in the Shulchan Aruch in the laws of Gerus, when a person becomes a ger. I don't think they do this custom today, but this is what's brought that used to be the custom. I don't know when it stopped being the custom. And it's also brought in the laws of Chol HaMoed, where a person is not allowed to shave on Chol HaMoed. So over there, the Shulchan Aruch says, but let's say he does tshuva, and he used to serve in another religion, so they won't allow him to be part of the minyan. So he doesn't want to lose that on Chol HaMoed. So he's allowed to shave in order to immerse himself to become part of the minyan. Now this is a custom that's based on this Rashi here that quotes this Medrash. That's unclear what the source of the Medrash is, but it's brought in halacha, and because of that we would even let a person shave on Chol HaMoed. And that's in our parsha that the Levim had to shave all of their hair and then immerse their clothing and become pure to serve in the Mishkan. Sure.
So the Levim don't usually, or the Kohanim don't usually have to shave their hair?
This was a one-time thing. Kohanim in general were not allowed to have hair that was longer than 30 days growth. And the Kohen Gadol had to have a very, very short haircut. The Navi in Yecheskel describes it as Kesus Yechsemut Rashehim. They get very, very close haircuts. The Kohen Gadol had a haircut that was so close that every hair would reach the root of the next hair. So imagine how short that is. Every hair was very, very short. And the Kohen Gadol had to get a special haircut every day. Rabbi Yehuda Anasi had a son-in-law who wanted to figure out how you get such a haircut. His name was Ben Elosa. And he spent a lot of money. He had a wealthy father-in-law. His father-in-law was the Nasi. So he spent a lot of money to get a barber who would be able to give him this haircut. He tried to get it down pat. So that special haircut got the nickname Tisporet Ben Elasa. You're talking about after the destruction of the Second Temple. So in the time of the First Temple, the Second Temple, time of the Mishkan, every Kohen Gadol got it. But this guy tried to redo it, so then it got a nickname after him. It's called Tisporet Ben Elasa. The haircut of Rebbe's son-in-law is called Ben Elasa. So that's the Kohen Gadol. But this is a one-time thing. This is a one-time thing for the Levim who are going to come in place of the Bechoros. They had to shave themselves clean. And this was a close shave. This was with a knife. Yeah. No payas, it seems, nothing. Everything was shaved off. No beard, no payas. Look, there's a rush. Rabbeinu Asher. He explains in his commentary on the Gemara that Aaron, the Kohen Gadol, was clean shaven. He didn't have a beard. Aaron, the high priest, Kohen Gadol, the pasuk in Tehillim describes Kashem Natov Ayored Al Zekan Zekan Aaron, the good oil that Aaron was anointed with that goes down. The pasuk describes and drips down Aaron's beard. So the Rush explains that the oil, the Shem Namishkan, dripped down Aaron's face, and he was clean shaven. He had to shave everything off. He was shaven, and two drops of oil clung to the bottom of his chin till the day he died, and that was instead of a beard. He never had a beard. Aaron, he had two drops of oil that miraculously stayed there, or their effect stayed there, whatever that means. The rush. It's a rush on a Gemara and Hurrius. So the Levim in our parsha are given over to start their service. And their service, we've discussed, consisted of a few things. They're the ones who sing in the Beis HaMikdash, the time of the sacrifice. They're the ones who are guards. They watch over the doors. These are guards of honor. It's like the queen's guards. They're not really there to protect anything, but they're guards. And in the time of the Mishkan, they also had jobs as far as carrying the different parts of the Mishkan when we travel. Now Moshe Rabbeinu tells the Levim that from age 25 and up, they come to serve until the age of 50. And at the age of 50, they leave their post. From that time on, they're not going to do what they did until now. Now, there's another pasuk which says that they work from age 30 to 50. So our sages say, which one is it? How come one pasuk says they start working at 25, and the other pasuk says at age 30? So our sages say they come at age 25 and start learning, and they'd spend 5 years learning. And then at age 30, if they had it down pat, they'd start working. So what happens if at age 30 they didn't get it? So then our sages say, if they didn't get it by that time, then we'd let him go. A person has to give himself 5 years to see if he's successful in learning. If he puts 5 years, he takes 5 years out of his life and spends them focused on learning, and he sees he's not getting anywhere, so then we say, okay, he's not going to make it. But minimum of 5 years. This is something we have to talk about at length. What does that mean?
They started learning at 25.
They started learning their job, the halachos of what a Levi has to do at age 25, yeah. That's also something that's interesting. Today they start teaching kid at age 5, 6, 7, all the halachos. And our tradition is that ben chamesh lamikra, when a kid becomes 5 years old, you start teaching him chamesh. You teach him all the practical things. You tell him this is a tzitzis and you put it on. And you could teach him the psukim about it. You tell him this is how you wash your hands in the morning, this is how you shake a lulav. When he's old enough to understand, each mitzvah we give it to him as he understands. Today you walk into Shari Tzedek Hospital, you see the parents are putting yarmulkes on the kids from the time they're born. So the truth is that the Gemara records that there was the mother of one Amora that the stargazers told her that her son's going to be a robber. So she was scared. She said he's going to be a robber. So she made sure he had a yarmulke on his head from the time he was very little. And she said, never take the yarmulke off your head. You got to be a God-fearing person. But we see that she was unusual, that no one else did this. The Gemara records her as the exception. But today you walk into the hospital, you see half the babies there have yarmulkes on their head already. So if it's the winter, why not? Why shouldn't they be kept warmer? But if it's the summer, why should the kids suffer? So okay, they want to, they could. There's nothing wrong with it. But halacha says that chinuch for a child goes by when he understands. When he begins understanding a concept, that's when you have a mitzvah to teach him that concept. There's no mitzvah of having a kid shake a lulav and esrog when he doesn't understand what he's doing. Once he understands, then you teach him that. But as far as teaching and learning with a kid, so we say from 5 years old to 10 years old, you teach him the Chumash, you teach him the Navi, you teach him Tanakh. At age 10, you start teaching him Mishnah. Till age 15, you go to the average cheder, at age 10, they're already teaching them Gemara. But the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos that at 10 years old, you start teaching them Mishnayos. You don't go into depth explaining them the reasonings. You teach them the basic laws in Mishnah. And only at age 15 do you start teaching the kid Gemara, the deep concepts of the Mishnah. So over here, the Levim start learning these laws at age 25. It's not surprising. They have to understand what they're doing. Okay. So...
And at this time, the Torah had only been given for maybe 10, 15 years?
At this time, the Torah had been given 10 months ago. 11 months ago.
Not anybody could really study the Torah.
They were all studying. They were studying day and night. What did they need? God was giving them food from heaven. Their clothing were fine. They didn't have to work. So all they had to do was learn Torah. our sages say that the Levim, when they reached age 50, then they wouldn't do the hard work. Then they would start working as guards by the doors. And this was only in the Midbar. Once we entered the land of Israel, so a Levi could work unlimited. He could work till he no longer had a good voice. The Levim, one of their main jobs was singing. So some of them, their job was singing. Some of them was watching. So if his voice went bad, so then he would go back to watching the doors. He'd be a guardsman. And the Kohanim, if a Kohen got a mum, he got a blemish, so then their job would be to take out the worms from the wood that would be sacrificed on the Mizbech. Now the Torah tells us that the Jews hit the second year. It's the month of Nisan. They're still holding at Har Sinai. We haven't left Har Sinai yet. And they bring the Korban Pesach. It's time to bring the Korban Pesach, but they have a problem. This year, Pesach falls out on Shabbos. So they're the second year in the desert, and Pesach falls out on Shabbos, and they don't know, do they bring a Korban Pesach on Shabbos or not? So we have a repeat of the commandment. God tells them, now that they're in the desert, they should bring a Korban Pesach, and Pesach overrides Shabbos. You bring a Korban Pesach even on Shabbos. So that's what they did. Now here we see that Moshe does a review with them of the laws of Pesach because it's time for them to bring the Korban Pesach, and this is something we should all learn from. People sometimes feel, oh, I learned that last year. Why should I review it? Well, when halacha becomes relevant, we should review it. That's what we have here, classes to review. The laws of Pesach before Pesach, the laws of Yom Tov before Yom Tov, the laws of fast before fast. Even if a person learned it, a person should review it when it comes close to the time that's going to be applicable. And that's what Moshe Rabbeinu did here. He reviewed with the Jews the laws of Pesach because Pesach was coming up a second time. We have a tradition that the 40 years that the Jews were in the desert, this was the only Korban Pesach that they brought. And the reason is that they didn't circumcise their children in the desert. And one who has a child that's uncircumcised can't bring a Korban Pesach. So our sages say, why didn't they circumcise their children? Our sages say that there's a special northern wind that helps a child get cured from the circumcision. And that wind wasn't brewing when they were in the desert. And they saw that if they circumcise their children in the desert, then the children will be endangered. The tribe of Levi, they said, we don't care, we have a mitzvah to circumcise, we're circumcising. So when the Jews enter the land of Israel, one of the first things we do is we have a mass circumcision. They have a hill of arlas, of the foreskin. They circumcised so many people, they had a hill of foreskins. And the place was called Givat Ha'aralot, the hilltop of foreskins. When we entered the land of Israel, because we entered the land of Israel directly prior to Pesach. Just a second, 40 years later, when we entered the land of Israel, so we have mass circumcision. And God says, now I've removed the disgrace of the Jewish people. So what's the disgrace? So our sages say that the Jews had an excuse. They could say, you know, it's dangerous to do circumcision in the desert under these conditions. But the tribe of Levi, nonetheless, they circumcised their children. And we don't find that they died because of this. So our sages say that this was an excuse that they could get away with, and that's why they weren't punished for it. But it's still a shame for the Jewish people. And that's why this story really belongs in the beginning of the Sefer, in the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar. Sefer Bamidbar begins a month later. 2 months later, we pointed this out when we began, that the Sefer Bamidbar begins in the month of Iyar. And now we're going back to the month of Nisan. So it's written out of order, this section. So the reason is because God didn't want to begin this book with the shame of the Jewish people. What are we supposed to be ashamed about? If this is the only Korban Pesach we brought throughout the time we were in the desert. But that's not our fault. We couldn't circumcise our kids. So the answer is we had an excuse. But when a person has an excuse, doesn't mean he has nothing to be ashamed about. Sometimes an excuse is just that, an excuse. So even a good excuse, at the end of the day, it's still an excuse. And we see that the Levim did circumcise their kids. You want to ask something?
When the Pesach was on the
14th
Nisan, yeah?
That's not a good excuse.
On the 14th we sacrifice, on the 15th is... I think Shabbos was on the 14th, so they didn't know whether to bring it on Shabbos or not. So they bring the Korban Pesach. They're holding this. This is the second year, meaning it's a year from the time they left Mitzrayim. The first Korban Pesach was brought in Mitzrayim. This is the first Korban Pesach that's being brought outside of Mitzrayim. We're here, we've been in the desert a full year. And at Mount Sinai, we bring this Korban Pesach. We've been at Mount Sinai now for 10 months. They bring the Korban Pesach. And then there were people who were tameh. They were defiled. They had been traveling one day and they came across a dead man. They started asking, does anyone know who this person is? And no one knew who he was. So they had no choice. They had to take that person and bury him. It's a big mitzvah. But at the end of the day, they have to wait 7 days till they become pure. And their 7 days would have ended that night. So they came to Moshe and they said, look, let us partake in the Korban Pesach. Let us be enumerated as one of those who are bringing this Korban. Because at night, when it comes time to eat from it, we're going to be pure. Tonight we'll be okay. So just now that we're still, today's the seventh day since we got defiled. We had sprinkled on us from the red heifer the ashes of the Parah Aduma on the third day, and today on the seventh day. Tonight we're going to be pure. Let us partake from the Korban Pesach. And Moshe Rabbeinu said, gee, I don't know. I have to ask God. Let me ask God. And here we see a few things. One of the things we see is the great level Moshe Rabbeinu was on. The Rambam describes that what's a prophet? A prophet is someone who works on himself, purifies all his traits, and then he waits and prays and hopes that God will give him some prophecy. So the Rambam says a person could spend his whole life on this high level, fit for prophecy, and he'll never get it. A person could spend his whole life on that level, and suddenly there'll be a flash like lightning. It's like a person that's walking in the darkness in the forest. Suddenly there's a flash of lightning. He sees what's going on. A second later, it's dark. That's how the prophecy is. So the Rambam says a prophet is waiting. He's prepared himself. He's fit. He's on the level. He's happy. He's ready to get prophecy. And he might get a flash of lightning at some point in his life. He might not. He might get 2 flashes. He might get 10 flashes. Moshe Rabbeinu was like a person who has constant flashes of lightning. It's all light. So that's what we see here. They come to him with a question. He says, I don't know. He could say, I'll ask God, and he knows he'll get an answer. That's Moshe Rabbeinu, only Moshe Rabbeinu. So that's one thing we see. The second thing we see is that the Torah tells us a story. The Torah doesn't use extra words. Why doesn't the Torah just tell us the laws? What happens if a person is impure when comes time for the Pesach? The halacha is so-and-so. Here the Torah doesn't do that. The Torah gives all the introduction. These people walked in. They said, we're impure. Why should we be left out? We want a part. And Moshe Rabbeinu says, gee, I don't know. Let me ask God. And then the whole answer. Why do we need this whole story? What's the importance? So our sages say, this teaches us, megalgelin schut al yedei zakai. That when a merit has to come to the world and something good has to come to the world, God tries to do it through good people. That's a rule we have. Megalgelin schut, good things come to the world, al yedei zakai, through good people. And megalgelin chova al yedei chayav, the other way around is also true. Bad things come to the world through bad people. The Gemara records that there was an Amora that Eliyahu Hanavi used to visit him. And Eliyahu would always visit him and learn with him. One time, a bandit fled into his town. And the authorities, the Romans came, they surrounded the town, and they said, we're going to kill everyone in the town unless you give up that guy. So the halacha says that if people surround the town, if non-Jews surround the town, and they say, give up a Jew, or we'll kill all of you, so you don't give up a Jew. But if that person really deserves to be killed, and they say, we want that specific person, or we'll kill all of you, so then they could give up that specific person. Again, we're skipping over many opinions and many details, but in short, that's the halacha. So this rabbi, he said, look, this is the halacha, we're giving him over. So they gave him over to the authorities, and he was taken. And Eliyahu wouldn't show up to him. And he didn't understand, why is Eliyahu not coming to him? Finally, when he got to speak to Eliyahu, so he asked Eliyahu, why didn't you come? So Eliyahu said, you gave over a Jew. What do you mean, why didn't I come? So he said, but it's a Mishnah. What did I do wrong? That's the halacha. So Eliyahu said, yeah, it's a Mishnah. But is it Mishnat Hasidim? Is it something that Hasidim are supposed to do? That's the halacha. It's true. Someone else could have done it. You don't have to be the one to jump up and give him over. It's true, that's the halacha. So sometimes, even things that are the halacha, we say, Megalgilin Schut Aidei Zakai, a person who merits, he's going to merit to bring good things to the world. People should always try to give good news. Bad news, you don't have to be the one to give. Even if it means telling about someone that passed away. Why do you have to say that? Rav Avadia says that one should refrain from giving bad news, so much so that even if a person knows about someone else's relative who passed away, and that person has to sit Shiva, and if you don't tell him, he won't sit Shiva. So Rav Avadia says, okay, don't say anything. That's not your problem. He will sit Shiva. He won't sit Shiva. That's not your problem. It says, Motzi dibahu ksil. A fool is the one that gives out bad news. Don't be the one to give over bad news. The custom that evolved many, many generations ago was that when a person passed away, so the houses near that person would pour out their water. So there are different explanations to that custom. One explanation says that the Malach HaMavis, when he comes and kills a person, so he takes a sword and he dips the blood off in the water that he finds in the homes surrounding them. The 2-3 homes that live near the person, he dips his sword in there. So there's a drop of blood in the water, we pour it out. Another understanding says that there's a bad spirit. It's dangerous to drink that water. And a third understanding says that no one wants to spread the word that this man died. So the sign that evolved to show that a person died was that all the neighbors would pour out the water from their house. And everyone saw the neighbors going and pouring out the water, so they'd understand no one pours out water. You'll have to go to the well and draw it out again. So if people are pouring out water, it was a sign that someone passed away. So here we have these people, these righteous people who come forth and they say, why should we be left out? Twice in the Torah we're going to see, in 2-3 weeks, someone else is going to say, why should we be left out? The daughters of Tzafchat. People walked up and said, I don't want to be left out. And both times they got their wish. And this teaches us something. A person who wants to be a part of good things, a person who wants to partake of things that are holy, God likes that. People should complain when they're left out of things that are good. Our sages say that the verse says, "Muvat lo yochal itkon," something that's completely warped, you can't fix it. So our sages say, what is it in this world that's so warped you can't fix? So there are different understandings. One understanding says if a person has relations that are illicit to the extent that the child is a mamzer. So there, the child's born, he's a mamzer, he can't fix that. That's it, the kid's in the world, he's a mamzer. There are different understandings in the Gemara. One understanding the Gemara offers is muvat lo yochal itkon. The Gemara says that's shenimnu chaverav ledvar mitzvah. His friends all agree, let's go do this mitzvah, let's go visit this sick person, let's go help this person out, and he stays behind. That's called muvat lo yochal itkon. He's warped and he won't be able to fix it. He missed his chance. So here the people here see the Jewish people are going to bring a sacrifice and they want to partake. So they walk up to Moshe Ben and they say, we don't want to be left out. Help us out. And Moshe turns to Hashem and Hashem says they cannot partake of this Korban Pesach. The halacha is that if a person is impure at the time of bringing the Korban Pesach, he cannot partake, but they get a second chance. And here we get the concept of Pesach Sheni, and we'll discuss that in a few minutes, but right now let's break. And,